out, and we've got a reason to cheer and shout. Summer break, let's shake. Summer break, let's shake and celebrate. For goodness sake, all the work we've done the whole year long. Ooh.
Ah, summer break. Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most recreational work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're back. Back for some more summer break. But before we get into that, a reminder that All Packed Up 2, All Paled Up, Beyond the Pale, is coming soon.
Mm-hmm. We've been getting various materials for that, whether it's commission things or the props we're purchasing. It's all coming together. We're really excited for it.
Yes. One of the segments that we haven't yet talked about that is making a return from All Packed Up 1 is meals, themed meals. So in All Packed Up 1, we had a number of meals that were themed after food from Packed, and now we're going to have a bunch of meals themed after food from Pale.
Yep, it's a 25-hour live stream. We've got to eat at some point.
We've got to eat at some point, yeah. I don't know if we should mention the meals yet. They're still to be finalized, I think, but we've got some, there's more food that shows up in the story than you would think, and we've got some fun ones.
Yeah, exactly. I think it should be a lot of fun. The ones we did for All Packed Up were really good, although I remember I really struggled to eat the last one just because we were drinking so much, both alcoholic and just like volumetrically, that I was still really full.
Yeah.
So we'll see how we go with all this food.
Yeah, true. Anyway, should we get into the actual chapters?
Yeah, let's do it.
First up, Summer Break 13.4, we're with Lucy. We have 7 days left before summer break, and the tension between Verona and Lucy definitely hasn't fully dissipated. Lucy prepares some spell cards for battle.
Yeah, and it's worth calling out, Ruben and I both accidentally noted this separately. this chapter opens with 1 week until the end of summer as its own paragraph. And then the next chapter opens with 6 more days of this, then the end of summer, which gave us both like countdown vibes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if the next chapter opens with, only 5 days left until the end of summer, then we'll definitely know Wabo is 100% counting down the remaining arcs before, I guess, the finale of the story.
Yeah, like especially knowing Otherverse stories, what a countdown of a chapter a day tells me is that the last day will be at least an arc.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, we'll get to 1 day left and then that will be like 5 chapters or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
If not more.
There's also a bit here that's worth calling out where like Lucy and Verona sort of recount all of the hanging threads that are going on right now. Like they mention, this is what we've got to solve. Like, you know, they bring back up the beautiful man and the fey animals, which despite me falling in love with them at the time, I had kind of forgotten about. So like, I do really appreciate Wabo every now and then just reminding us, the audience, like of all the shit we need to worry about via the characters, like recapping all the shit they need to worry about.
Yeah, there's a Marisica reference briefly in the next chapter as well. And I think it's important for Wabo to just remind us that while Marisica may be forgotten, she is not gone. She is almost certainly coming back in some form, or her influence is coming back to, you know, resolve the Carmine threat. So
what jumped out to me the most on the Marisica front in these two chapters is there's a bit where I think Verona mentions that she's like equipped herself with some of like Guillaume's glamour. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure Verona was almost exclusively rocking Marisica glamour in the first half of the story. I think she had both usually, but like she definitely has always lent much more to the Marisica side of things. I just like that really jumped out to me as like, like, you know, that's how far we've moved on now, is that Verona's prioritizing Guillaume's glamour.
The setup of these spell cards is fun as well. I mean, you know, great work by Wabo introducing them here, giving Lucy some space to go over them before we get into the actual conflict that we're going to have to use them in. Even if I still feel like I only really have a rough understanding of how runes function. Like, you know, Lucy describes the runes and I still find it still a little bit hard to quantifiably picture exactly what that means in my head.
Yeah, I mean, like, this system just continues to develop and get more and more, like, complex isn't quite the word, just, like, broad. Like, it's just more and more content in it. Like here we learn three new connection sort of runes and sort of see how there's a whole system that's borrowing from the tarot for, you know, how all these runes how all these different connection runes sort of relate. So yeah, like the Fool is just sort of the simple one that kind of works all the time but also can just completely break, and then you've got like ones for nature and just amazing extra detail that it's crazy we're getting so late in this story.
I think it's also a very clever play by Lucy to use magic to trick Verona into continuing to talk to her.
it's like one of those things where part of me instinctively wanted to sort of see it as manipulative, but then in a way doing nice things for friends and family is manipulative. Like, it depends where it's coming from, I guess, is the distinction. And like here, Lucy kind of gives you the vibe of like, she's glad that the practice is bringing them together more than she's specifically doing this to trick Verona. It's almost just like she is doing it, and then Verona comes up and is nice to her, and she's like, "Oh, this is good."
Yeah, yeah.
I did really enjoy the part where there's the piece of paper that she's like put on a rune that'll like stick to someone who's like aggressive and hateful towards her. And it sticks to Verona for just a couple of seconds, and Lucy tries to use that as a wedge. And Verona's not going to be so easily swayed into talking about her feelings, so it doesn't work. But it was a noble effort that caused me to laugh, so that was fun.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny as well. Lucy, she just can't leave it alone, can she?
No, and I mean, I get it. Like, we're going to be talking. I mean, this is one of those weeks. And I think Matt and Scott used to say this all the time too, but it's one of those weeks where I'm really glad these are the two chapters we get to do together. Because it's kind of like the A side and the B side of this Lucy Verona conflict. Like, it's what both of them are dealing with for a lot of their chapter this week. So this is a great pair to go together. Like, this conflict is becoming a little bit grayer and messier on both their ends as they're finally realizing this isn't about Jeremy really. And that's cool. I mean, we'll be talking about that a lot today, I think.
Definitely. So the next thing that happens is they go down for breakfast, and Jasmine is kind of mediating their relationship a little bit before she drops a few mixed bits of news for Verona.
I love how she thinks Verona's mom coming would be good news, and it's kind of
a bit caught off guard. I'm surprised. I mean, no, I know why Verona doesn't take it as that good of news, but yeah, I think it's nice. And Verona clearly, you know, jumping ahead a bit, after Verona's mom leaves and Verona doesn't get as much time to hang out with her as she thought, she's clearly disappointed by that. So
yeah, it's like Verona sort of said when she hung out with her mum for those 2 weeks. Like, it was in that chapter, Verona was sort of like, yeah, you know, it can take us a while to find our groove, but then we get into it and it's really good.
Mm.
And so, like, it would make sense that something you sort of view that way is something that you don't look forward to, but then once you're there, it's like going to the gym, right? Like, when you're at home getting ready, you really don't want to go, but then you get there and you start to get, like, the endorphin hit from exercising, and you're like, oh, this was a good idea. It felt like that to me.
Mm.
And then, of course, there's the whole angle Jasmine doesn't know, where this is just an extra thing Verona has to deal with in, like, Hell Week.
Yes, 100%. It's not great timing, is it?
No, but it wouldn't be fun if it was.
Mm.
It was funny, like, just reading this chapter in particular, but really the entire pair, like, as we're about to get into the whole Lucy and Verona fight stuff, particularly in this part of this chapter, reading these two chapters was almost felt like a bit of a hit piece on me, because I was so able to relate to where Verona's coming from. Particularly seeing it from Lucy's perspective here felt like I was reading a chapter from the perspective of, like, my ex after we used to have fights. Because, to cut a long story short, when we would fight, if it happened like in the evening, it'd be one of those things where something had been boiling for weeks, say. We'd have a big fight. We'd sort of yell at each other. Nothing would actually get fixed. But like through the yelling, I'd just sort of be like, okay, we're not getting anywhere with the yelling.
That's resolved the emotional tension.
Yeah, I'd just be like, yeah, I let's just call this resolved for now. And like, you know, I need to think about it. And then I'm one of those people who can just like roll over in bed and fall asleep.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so then the next morning I basically find out from her that she's been like, you know, she was awake for 4 hours stressing, worrying, and then she tried to bring it up in the morning, and I'd be like, no, we did this last night, it's all fixed now. And so watching Verona do this to Lucy, I was just like, oh Jesus Christ. Like, because you know, I think as the relationship went on, as I got older, I got better at understanding why that probably wasn't okay for me to do to my girlfriend at the time. So watching Verona do this to Lucy was just like an attack on my younger self.
Yeah, I also related a lot to the idea that I feel like in arguments or just kind of emotional situations at all, I'm very much able to, you know, get into the emotional situation, but then turn it off and go and, you know, do other things and put it aside, which definitely felt like a Verona in this situation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you're like that, it's easy to get a bit frustrated at the people who can't do that. But I actually think it's very fair if you can't do that.
Yes, 100%. And I think, speaking of that, like, of course it's the perfect extension of who Lucy is that she just can't let these arguments go. Like, obviously a flaw in this breakfast that she does is she just kind of has those little, like, not even jabs, because they're not quite jabs, but they're
any tiny opportunity that presents itself, she's going to sneak in there.
Just a slight little needle.
Wedge. Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's shitty of her to do, 100%, but it fits into her, like, vibe of she's so about, and I mean, this is, again, why this conflict is so great, because I feel like I relate to both Verona and Lucy, right? It's this thing of, like, Lucy knows that there's something that still needs to be resolved, and it kind of runs counter to her whole ethos to just be like, there's something that is a problem here, and I just have to let it go. Like, of course, Lucy's whole deal is not letting things slide, and we've seen her struggling with this in the past arc especially. And this is just a perfect representation of showing why that's a flaw when it's applied to a, you know, a friendship of just like, sometimes if you want to maintain a healthy friendship, you just have to be more chill, Lucy.
Like, you're right, she kind of gets a bit more explicit in this later with her talk with John, but like she's really starting to see how this fits into her overall character arc of I think how she phrases it early in the chapter here is she the person who carries knives and you know does the bloody fighting that can get grisly and she doesn't like, or is she the person who smoke who finds other ways and moves around stuff but is potentially not effective enough, like doesn't physically do enough. And you're right, I love that she's sort of tying into this, because I mean it's tricky with the Jeremy example in particular, and I'm glad we'll get to it, but obviously she starts to realize that that's not quite what it's about. And you know, yeah, that, you know, sometimes you do, I guess, just need to drop it.
100%. And then, I think Verona has quite strong reactions to lots of parts of this news, and we'll get into this more next chapter, but it really just feels like Verona's completely moved into avoiding her problems. Like, she's living on holiday time, living at Lucy's house, at the Ellingson residence, and it's like she's just refusing to engage with the fact that this is going to have to come to an end.
Yeah, obviously that will be a topic of next chapter, because that's almost the theme for Verona in that chapter. But I guess, like, as an intro, because the sort of vibe I got from seeing this in this chapter was like feeling like, oh, I understand that hearing that the cast person wants to sit down with you this week with all the shit on your plate this week is just like, you just want to say no. And that's totally reasonable. But on the other hand, it's like, my understanding is it's basically the day after all the shit's going to go down with the Carmine, the next day she's meant to move in back with her dad. So on the one hand, like, yes, I get that it's very reasonable to not want to have to deal with your dad and this cast stuff right now. But on the other hand, that's like a luxury you just may not have right now.
When is she going to be able to deal with it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that just may not be an option. So, yeah, it's a tough one. And I think that's, like, Verona gets her piece at the end of the next chapter, and we'll get there. But there's going to be times where she can't get that, and that's going to be interesting. She's going to come up against some walls, and we'll have to see how she does. It's also easy to skip over here, we almost did. They're not grounded anymore.
Hey!
Jasmine continues to put a lot of faith in these two.
Yeah.
I really like her stipulations. Like, she calls it probation, actually, which I really like. She's like, listen, you know, Jespery and Zed came around. They said, you know, you're doing really good. So even though other bad stuff's gone down, like, we'll call it time served.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, this is good, because that's sort of what you want the focus of rehabilitative justice stuff to be, right? Like, you want it to be, hey, it turns out, like, you know, you were doing better than we thought, so we're going to loosen things up and, like, give you a bit more freedom. But, like, you know, like, as Jazz said, if she comes back and shit's bad, like, you know, then we'll reevaluate. Like, that's just exactly what you want things like this to look like.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the first thing they both do is sneak out and literally go fight monsters. So, I don't know. Like, Jazz, you might want to keep them grounded permanently.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny because Jazz is acting like a very reasonable adult in the situation where these kids are kids.
But they have been, I mean, I think Lucy remarks on it here by thinking, you know, they have not at all been sticking to this grounding. Yeah. Like, they snuck out multiple times using magic.
Like, I feel a bit bad for Jazz, because I think she's doing this really good thing. Like, yeah, they have been doing a lot of good stuff, but they are essentially operating with her in very bad faith by 100%. Consistently lying to her. Yeah. And it's a fair bad faith, because telling her is arguably worse.
Yeah.
It's just like, God, you almost start to wonder, considering how on the ball Jazz usually is, part of me is like, is there some practice shit going on that's making her not think about the suspicious, like, fact that, you know, like, she casually thinks, she sort of says something like, oh, I wish you'd called an ambulance for Bree, and weren't just, like, hanging out downtown. And there's still not really a question of, why were you hanging out downtown? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I think that Jasmine is taking what Bree said at the level that Bree meant it, you know, which is just like, they're doing great. Yeah,
it's just so funny, because, like, the majority part of me looks at everything Jasmine's doing and thinking, fuck, you're a good parent, this is so perfect. But then if you zoom out another layer, she's now just given them more freedom to go out and fight monsters and get in really dangerous situations. And, like, in a way, it's actually worse parenting to be a good parent like this. It's just it's just such a, like, shitty situation that, you know, she's sort of been put in by having kids as practitioners she doesn't know about. Also, I wanted to shout out the moment where Verona mentions that, Jazz mentions that she's going out for dinner, and Verona, of course, gets nosy about it as a relationship, just to fuck with her. And I was surprised to see you not coming with some tinfoil about how this was clearly, like, Musa or someone, like, on Musa's team.
I mean, who do you think it would be? I don't know. Maybe it's a witch hunter, or maybe she's fallen for it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's anybody.
Yeah, there's no one in her age group except for Abe, right?
I think I saw a fan theory about why, but that feels like it's not age appropriate to me.
No, because he's like 25, right? Whereas I'm assuming Jazz is in her 40s.
Yeah, probably early, mid, yeah.
Well, Booker's 18, so yeah, she's got to be like at least mid-30s, you'd sort of assume.
I don't know. I don't think it's anybody.
Oh, what if it's the handsome man?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was just shocked that you weren't coming with some tinfoil theory of your own.
I'm sorry, I just didn't. I only do tinfoil theories when I truly believe them, you know? Aunt Heather is actually a practitioner.
Sorry, when did we start this policy? Okay.
But I don't think this is worth tinfoiling over. I don't think there's going to be anything here.
watch as this is the one secret practitioner in the whole fucking story.
Lucy goes off to find John, and they're kind of spying on Musser and his others and just kind of, you know, strategizing, I suppose.
Yeah, and on the way, she runs into Ram Jam, who just makes another, like, short and delightful appearance. That's very quickly become his MO in this story, is to just appear in a scene, absolutely make you fall in love with him, and then disappear for an arc or so. He's quickly turned into, I think, one of the fan favorite, definitely one of my favorite, like, side characters.
Yeah, this bit with Ram Jam is very fun.
He's also consistently right on the money with, like, great advice for everyone. Like this one, very unwarranted, but like he talks about douching, and he's like spot on that, like, I'm pretty sure all medical advice is that it's a really bad idea. But like, you know, the other times he's given like Avery really good advice, like, I don't know, he like people kind of write him off as a bit of an idiot, but he's kind of been right about everything he said so far.
Yeah, he's a clever goblin for sure. We get some time looking over Musser and his others, and we get a bit of information. We get kind of teasers for each of the monsters that he's carrying around with him here. One of them is four kids in a trench coat, which I think is hilarious. I think it's great that Wubbo has taken that, you know, trope and turned it into a cool and scary and wonderful idea for a monster.
Yeah.
So that one's probably my favorite, but.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was cackling as I read that description. It took a while to unfold, and I was like, wait, this scary ass monster is just four people in a trench coat? Like, yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah, but of course, Wubbo's put his own twist on it, like, whichever one is the head kind of influences what they're wearing and the powers that they have, which is such a cool idea. Like, yeah.
Well, especially because the way they change that is to like fall over and everyone shuffles under the cloak. So, so good. They all sound pretty great. I mean, obviously we met Nova briefly in Reed's interlude. So we kind of know what her deal is, but like the one that scares me the most is the one we don't really know anything about, which is that woman with the different appearances to everyone who sees her.
Or not necessarily everyone, maybe just these two.
That's true. She could just have like three forms or something.
Yeah.
I just assumed, given their depictions of her were so different, that was probably unique for everyone.
Imagine if literally every other character that sees this other sees them the same way as John, and Lucy's just the only one who sees something different, and it's just never explained.
I haven't really had a chance to think about like what her deal could be yet, but like the fact that like Lucy and John weren't really able to put it together at all is like kind of worrying. She just sort of leaks a bunch of like very intense spirity echoey energy. Like, is she a super Edith? Or the fact that everyone saw her a bit differently made me think of the paths. I was wondering if she's some sort of lost, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows?
Who haven't we talked about yet? Rabbit Killer, the guy.
Yes, Rabbit Killer. The musician guy. Yeah. Who is apparently some kind of cute doctor, perhaps, or...
There it is.
But yeah, like, regardless... We don't get to know this. We kind of, these are just teasers for each of them, but the impression that we get from it is very much like Musa has put together a very intentionally cultivated harem. Are they a harem of others? A cabal? And it's like the way that this unfolds with the suited man being the chaos factor is just like a clear implication that not only has Musa put together very intentional groups, but is explicitly kind of covering his weaknesses and stuff like that. Like it's very much this is going to be a very seriously tough fight kind of setup.
Yeah. Like we knew he was sort of powerful, but like now it's sort of becoming a bit of a show don't tell situation. Like as we're seeing him, like this just shows a really keen, like tactical insight. Like the fact that he knows that, yeah, if everything was ordered and he has, that like all the control and everything, that he becomes predictable. So, the fact that like he intentionally has taken someone who's going to like add a chaos factor is just so smart. Like, it's really worrying. And I mean, I think we've mentioned this before, but obviously, like, you continue to sort of see the comparisons and contrasts to Kennet in that, like, he has this diverse range of others, and they're all powerful in their own ways. And so they come together as a team to be, like, really good with each other. Meanwhile, we've got, like, Kennet falling apart, and that's this fucking depressing irony of, like, you want Kennet to be the one to succeed, but they're a mess right now because people are stabbing each other in the back. John's about to learn some of his best friends have probably betrayed him.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Musa's, there's a very clear chain of command, so they're all effective as much as it's, like, fucking terrible. And, like, that's going to be, like, the ultimate part of this challenge here is, like, Kennet needs to come together and needs to work as effectively as Musa's team to win.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, but clearly we're finding out more and more that that's just not going to be possible, right? Like, you know, who have we got? We've got John, but no one else has showed up for a fight to help the Kenneteers in a while. John is like carrying the team right now, right?
I mean, yeah, like exactly. You know, there's people like, oh, Rook did some stuff in Reeds until
true, but true.
Yeah, like that's the it. I feel like the situation with Musa is almost going to have to come down to, unless like some weird shit with the Witch Hunters happens or something. Like they talk about getting reinforcements next chapter. But like for Kennet to scare Musa out, it's always going to have to come down to they're going to have to get together so they can be as effective and efficient as Musa's team, which means they all need to get on the same page. And that's such a cool concept to sort of like to prove that he's like bad and they're good. They have to prove that they can be better both morally and actually.
Yeah. And it just, I mean, it doesn't seem likely.
It's going to be a hard road to get from A to B right now. Yeah.
Mm.
Luckily, I mean, if anything can get them all on the same page for at least like one fight, it's probably wanting to fuck Musa's day up.
Mm. Yeah.
If Marisica came into town and was like, hey, can I just help you fight Musa and then I'll leave again and I won't do anything else? Like, I'd say yes to that.
I mean, that would be a terrible idea to say yes to, but I think it would be fun.
This is why a fairy would absolutely have, like, no trouble killing me.
Mm.
But, like, I guess I'm just saying, like, killing Musa's got to be bad enough that they'll pretty much all be like, okay, why don't we deal with this and then we can get back to the other bullshit.
Mm.
Like, I'd be willing to give, like, Liz, Marisica, Edith a fucking pass for the day. If they're helping to fight Musa, fucking end bring a truce that shit.
I mean, it would be fun to see. I don't know if I think it would be a good tactical idea for the Kennet others and Kenneteers to agree to. But yeah, so John and Lucia are chit chatting here, and she just starts talking about, let's call it team dynamics. She decides she needs an outside opinion from John on you know, her arguments that she's been having with Verona.
The moment where John's able to just turn this into team dynamics and not being about boys is just so fucking good. Like the way he just relaxes physically, like noticeably physically just relaxes because he's like, oh, I can make this about team dynamics. It was just like, this is a really sort of heartwarming and nice scene between the two of them, and it's moments like that that really make it.
Yeah. John is so good at this. Like he, and maybe it's just because it's him and Lucy and they kind of get each other on a pretty good level, but he's so certain that he'll be of no help to Lucy, but he tells her a few things that she needs to hear. And he really like helps her realize, you know, reflects things back to her that she needs, in a way that helps her realize what she actually is really kind of worried about and helps, you know, figure out what's going on in her own mind.
Yeah, like one of the first things he says is like, God, you know, what does he say? Like, you're better off asking that guy who just ate the raccoons than me for like love advice.
Yeah.
But like Lucy sort of says, oh, the fact that you're not really about love might actually be helpful here. And she ends up being exactly right, because the fact that John kind of refuses to let this be about Verona and Jeremy lets Lucy finally sort of take that step back and appreciate the bigger issue here, which is sort of what we've been gunning for. Admittedly, I think I've been more vocal about wanting Verona to do it because I tend to relate to her more, but like it's finally Lucy's turn to just be like, oh yeah, like this is a broader issue I'm having with like Verona and some of our communication and friendship issues.
Mm.
Just the fact that he kind of can't make it about Jeremy is actually what works, and I just love that.
Yeah.
It's why they're a great, like, you know, pairing. Like it's why they're able to help each other.
Yeah, it's really good. Like, it, John fucking nails it. Yeah, I mean, the sad part is this is a great lead-in to the conversation of how they work so well together. So Lucy, of course, finally asks the million-dollar question, and John says that he'll consider it, but by the end of this chapter, it doesn't seem good for the will they, won't they.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear that unless something's going to change, his answer is no. But he hasn't said no yet, so there's a chance.
Yeah, there's Wapo doesn't want to crush our dreams yet, just yet. He wants to keep hope alive so it stings all the more cruelly.
Why else bring this whole thing back up? Should have just left it dead. No, I mean, it'll be interesting. Like, eventually we're going to learn what John's deal is. And he seems to think Lucy will sort of be behind it. But it'll be interesting when we learn it to sort of think, is this actually what's good for John? Or, like, yeah, is it sacrificial bullshit? Because to say he's got, like, a problem or an addiction with self-sacrifice would be understating it. So I can't wait to sort of get a picture and weigh in, like, with the community on whether it actually makes sense for John to want that.
Something that's worth noting here is Lucy thinks to herself, why did this always come up, referring to the thought of Alexander's murder, the emotional sense of it, the memory of it, the smell of it. She thinks, why does this always come up when she wanted to ask John about being her familiar? And it's, I don't know if this is actually going to happen or not, but it feels like Lucy is close to figuring out that there's actually something going on here, which we, of course, know that there is. And it makes me think, if Lucy figures out that this was actually something intentionally done by Alex before he died, does that mean that she can counteract it? Does that mean she'll be able to undo it and then, you know, John will come around? I don't know. It seems possible.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know if what he did with that picture actually counts as augury. The thing with the practice is it's a little vague at times, or a lot of the time, as to like whether something is strictly A or B. Like all the lines between all these things are blurry on many dimensions. But one of the golden rules we've learnt with augury is sort of if people can look back, they can, like, you know, disrupt it, right? Like, you know, with Nicolette getting her eyes blown out by the glamour early on. Like, yeah, if this follows those same sorts of rules where if she's aware of it, she can undo it. I mean, that's possible. It depends on, yeah, what happened to the connection. Alex seemed very sure it wouldn't be undoable, but then he also was pretty sure he wasn't going to get shot in the head a few minutes later. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, what would be heartbreaking is if she does put it together and there isn't anything she can do about it. Just sort of having to know that you can't ever really have as good a relationship with this person as you were going to have because of what somebody else did. You can't undo that. That sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It feels like it's possible. This Lucy dropping this, like starting to figure it out, makes me feel like it's potentially possible, but we'd have to see, I suppose. It also feels like the kind of thing that might just never get resolved. And this is, I mean, or this is the resolution, you know, them not ending up as familiar and familiar.
I'm trying to remember if John explicitly knows, because the simulation John from a few chapters ago, the way he phrased it gave me the impression that he sort of knew. He was just being intentionally vague or not explicitly saying it. And I'm trying to remember from 10.A if John ever said anything knowing for sure, because he'd recognize the smell and stuff. I feel like John does know. I wonder if that's part of it.
Interesting. I didn't get that impression, but yeah.
I'd have to double check. I've only just had this thought, but like, yeah, it feels to me like he very well could know that that's what happened.
Yeah. Okay. John decides to go in while Musa, while old Abe, while honest Abe is distracted. John decides to go in, and Lucy is meant to just leave him to it, but she doesn't, because why would she let John sacrifice himself? And so a fight breaks out, and Lucy ends up helping John escape.
Yeah, she saves him from his fucking dumbass plan.
Yeah. John, we have seen him make sacrificial plays a few times, and he pulls through. But this time,
is the stupidest.
This is by far the stupidest. Like, this time, if Lucy left him to it as he told her to, he would be gone. 100% he would be gone, right?
Yeah.
Like, he is bare moments away from being defeated and then almost certainly bound. And, yeah, like, fuck, John, you're the one Kenneth other that is a bit of a powerhouse that we have left. Like, Matthew's obviously dealing with shit. Guillaume and Mariska are off the cards. Miss is out of town. We've got Rook, I suppose. And we've got Toadie and some goblins, so that's good. But, man, John, we need you. We need you, bud.
Yeah, although John's this really fun kind of powerful where in certain situations he's fucking useless and in others he's, like, unstoppable.
Yeah.
Which is always just such a great dynamic. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, losing John is a huge loss to this town's ability to be able to cope with the witch hunters and the musses. And just, like, I get him wanting to take this opportunity, but, like, it sounds like all he really did was break musses' glasses, which, assuming they're an implement or something, like, give it a week and they'll be back.
Mm. Yeah. Just come on, John.
Yeah, it was like, this was definitely the maddest I've been at one of the John sacrificial plays.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tend to get as worked up as Lucy about them, but like this one, I was like, what were you thinking? Like, how else did you see this going?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in his mind, even just for the shot at killing Musa is worth it.
Yeah, I just don't think he was realistically going to get to kill Musa, and I think he must have known that.
Yeah.
Like, he wanted to weaken him. And I like that he's consistently, one of the things that comes up a lot when he's talking to Lucy is his primary target is always Musa. He never even really thinks about directly going after the others. Because that is the other angle that makes it difficult to fight Musa is really, like, the damage you're doing to most of those familiars is, like, damage you're doing to, like, enslaved soldiers.
Yeah.
Like, some of them, like, what was the name of, not Drown, Reed's other one? Blackhorn.
Mm.
Blackhorn seemed like just a little bit of a piece of shit in real life. So it was, you know, it was sort of like he was going to seek fights anyway. So there's a little part of me that's like, any injury he takes in a fight is a little bit more forgivable. But like someone like Drown, like, you know, having to like permanently disable him or something in a fight is just, it lets you get to the muscles, but that's a bloody road to get there.
Yeah. I don't know. I think John thought he had a chance, but it was just so stupid. So clearly stupid. Lucy.
Also, sorry, for a dude who was just espousing the benefits of team dynamics.
Mate,
what were you thinking?
Lucy talks a bit more about betrayals, and John is saddened at the news of the goblin betrayal and needs some time to go off on his own.
I enjoy and have headcanoned his theory that they didn't end up getting Gashwad. Although, like, the smart part of my brain is telling me that if Mariska thought they could do it, that's probably more likely than John thinking they couldn't. But the smart part of my brain can go to hell because the emotional part likes Gashwad and doesn't want him to have been involved.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we just don't have the info we need to side with John on this. John is clearly just, well, not, you know, John is not doubting what Lucy is saying here at all, which is good of him. But I don't know. I think he's possibly a bit in denial.
Understandably. I mean, the interesting thing about the goblins, like the involvement of these two goblins has been getting a lot of the Kenneteers' focus. And what jumps out to me is interesting about that is, first of all, we know they were brought in sort of last minute, not really importantly. And also, Marisica knew the plan was going to work without them. She said she was only adding them to the plan for Edith and Charles's benefit to like help convince them. So there's almost this angle of like, any time you're spending focusing on the goblins and sorting them out is time that you're putting into culprits who, as Marisica said in Lucy's flashback, aren't actually going to affect whether or not the ruse is successful. So they're almost not worth worrying about as far as stopping them. Like, it really, you just need to go up to them, try to, I guess, outbid Marisica and or do something. But like, yeah. Like relative to all the other concerns they have, I actually am just kind of looking at them. Like, this is more of a personal betrayal, but like big picture, I don't think they're that important.
Yeah. It even feels like, from what we know, the goblins already might have moved on from being allied with the conspiracy, right? Like, we might have gotten past the point where they're a problem anyway.
Yeah, that's true. We don't know how long-term their involvement was going to be, but, like, I'd be surprised if the plan was for them to outlast Charles and Edith.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am interested, though, from, like, a character-y perspective on finding out what exactly what they were bought for. Like, I almost don't really care what they've actually had to do for the conspiracy, because knowing Marisica, you know, it'll be ultimately small potatoes stuff. But like, the framing has consistently been this sort of tension they have with Toad Swallow. And as it looks like Toad Swallow is maybe going to be involved in the conversation with them, I can't wait to, like, that's the more interesting part to me. Like, Toad Swallow, I think we talked about it when he first got nominated as the mayor, like, and it gets talked about here. Like, Blunt is used to big goblin meaning better goblin, and Toad Swallow challenges that. And what did Marisica promise them about Toad Swallow to get them on board? Like, I want to see Blunt actually have this conversation with Toad Swallow. That's the part I can't wait for.
Yeah, 100%. I think finding out why the goblins are doing what they're doing, I think will be very illustrative and just very fun to read.
Yeah, I think I've been vocally like a very big fan of this like subplot of like goblin culture and fixing that. And so I can't wait to see Toad Swallow and Blunt actually try to talk it out.
Yeah.
Cause as they mentioned, like, I think we've seen this and probably said it on the podcast, like Blunt isn't as stupid as he first appears. We've seen some real, like, he had that philosophical moment in Arc 11. I remember talking about like keeping tables upright. Like he's a surprisingly smart cookie in his own way.
And this chapter ends on a very sad note, which is basically as close to explicitly confirming that John's saying no as we're gonna get right now. It's rough. It's really rough. We knew it wasn't gonna happen, and it still breaks my heart.
Okay, here's an idea, right? So John made this deal with the three other judges, right? How quickly do you think we can whip up three more hungry choirs?
For each judge?
Yeah, let's just get rid of all the judges. I don't want them anymore.
Is that a plan that could be done?
John's kind of relying on their deal with him and the fact that he's got their support. Like, remember we weren't in the flashbacks that they kind of rig things in favor of their favored contestant? So if we just take them all out of the picture,
but
that'll make the world a better and safer place, I think. Let's just kill the other three judges.
And give them three more hungry choirs to deal with.
Yeah.
Three more almost certainly much stronger hungry choirs.
Yeah.
I'm sure Bree can handle it. Bree can just incorporate all of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because the problem in this story is the fact that it was only one judge was killed, and that's throwing things out of balance. If you kill them all, and then, you know,
balance restored.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we'll put slightly different flavors on each of the hungry choirs so that it helps Bree kind of balance out what she's got inside her. It's good for everyone.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, that's the end of 13.4. So let's get into 13.5, which is from Verona's perspective. We're back with Verona. We've got 6 days left. The countdown continues. And Verona is learning about goblin signaling and applying far too much structure and logic to this system for the goblins to appreciate it.
Yeah, or I would have phrased it more as they don't like the language she's using to describe it. It reminded me of like reading a friend's paper at college one time. He'd written this paper for a class that was like discussing like slang and etymology. It was like for some languages course. I was in engineering. I don't understand their courses and where they draw lines, but it was so funny reading like an academic paper talk about slang, because like you just have it, like there's this real tonal dissonance between using academic language to describe like second past principle blah blah blahs of like the word yo and stuff, like and that was like the vibe Verona was giving here too, is like the way she's sort of using all this highfalutin language to describe goblins running around yelling motherfucker at each other. It's just really funny, and you can tell how much it's irritating Gashwad. She just keeps doing it.
Yeah, I think it's very fun that she's basically just doing this just to fuck with Gash. I mean, she plays it up to fuck with Gash, which is the most goblin thing of all, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of flabbergasted at, like, unless I just completely misunderstood it, it wasn't a very simple code.
It seemed quite complex.
Yeah, like just being able to like run around mid combat, and even if you're just yelling out generic insults like fuck off you motherfucker, the way they were sort of like intoning it and shit to give clues to people nearby, I was like, I don't know that I'd be able to do that. That's really impressive.
Yeah, but Verona gets it very quickly. She's just like immediately gets it.
Yeah, whereas like, I remember we took beginner Cantonese together many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with listening to tones in that one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, yeah, I was impressed by, I guess, yeah, people call goblins dumb, but I was looking at this system and I was like, fuck, this is actually pretty complex.
Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Yeah, maybe I'm just dumb. Maybe I'm just dumb like a goblin.
No, I think there's a lot to it for sure. I mean, yeah.
Although saying that, in terms of how Gashwad's just getting annoyed by Verona, who is probably playing it up, Gashwad does have a great exit line here where he just says, your mother, and disappears.
Mm. And
Verona had the same reaction to me, which is just like pausing for a second, saying, is this some sort of yo mama joke I'm not getting? And then her mom literally shows up, and I was like, okay, that's good.
Yeah, it was a very funny moment, work, wasn't Gash. It? Good work by Gashwad. So yeah, Verona's mum proves that she's not the worst parent of all time by finally checking in with her daughter about all the clearly crazy stuff that she's hearing about from Jazz.
Yeah, and like she questions why Verona is looking for gifts for someone she describes as, like a 40-something man's man.
Mm.
And then, like, yeah, Verona gets a bit shitty when she's like, what exactly is your relationship with this man? And I'm like, no, Verona, that's a pretty fair question.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, because we know that's not your dad. And any other adult who you're, like, male who you're buying gifts for is like, look, your mum doesn't have a perfect track record, but she's trying now and she should probably know.
Yeah. Something that I found very interesting here was how much Verona is basically a younger reflection of her mum, right? Her mum immediately connects with her about the way that Verona kind of pulls away or disconnects from problems in order to kind of help herself process them a bit. And her mum pulls out that is a connection of when she was processing the divorce caused a problem because she was too far away to be a mother to Verona. And I think that's a very interesting way for Verona to see what it would be like being on the other side of somebody shutting off rather than being able to process something with you when there's tension. And it's clearly something that Verona has rightfully some resentment towards her mother for, as she should. And like, I think it's a very interesting way for Verona to be confronted with the fact that this is what can happen when you act the way that she and her mum would act in this situation. I think it's just a very beautiful and poetic way of this being shown to Verona. I think it's wonderful.
There's this great moment where her mum sort of clams up for a bit, and Verona thinks to herself, this isn't the silent treatment. Mum's not trying to give you the silent treatment. She's still just processing.
Mm.
It felt like the silent treatment. And I was like, oh, fuck, the irony of reading that from Verona's perspective after the last, like, 13 arcs of being in Lucy's head. You're right. Because, I mean, that's like that sort of thing, right? Like I have the same thing with my dad. There are definitely a lot of my dad's traits in me and my mom's as well. Mm. And there's definitely an aspect of like, as you start to recognize that as you grow up, of like, oh, I'm like my dad in this. You try to peel away the problematic parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, like it's so good for Verona to connect to her mom here because, like, on the one hand, you kind of see how much Verona's mom dropped the ball by not being around because Verona needed someone to talk to about this stuff. Like, this shouldn't be a revelation they're having now. It should have been a revelation that they both share this, like, ages ago. Mm. But ironically, it's like the fact that Sylvia dropped the ball so hard by doing this that will maybe get Verona to think on, like, the times when it's not ideal. Because, yeah, I'll talk about it more at the end of the chapter, but, like, cause I'm like this as well. Like, I was kind of hoping as I was reading this chapter, I was like, hey, I hope Verona just figures out the solution to this problem so Wildbo can just tell me how to stop being like this. Because I got called out by a friend this week because I just hadn't really been talking to him or and I'd actually failed to return a couple of phone calls of his, and he basically like started harassing me more because he was like, and when I finally answered the phone, he was like, I know you, what you do is you start talking less and you disappear more when you're stressed and not doing well.
Mm.
And I have been having like a pretty rough week. And so it was just sort of like, oh shit, called out like by him. And then it was like 2 days later, I sat down to read this chapter and I was like, oh, okay. could Wildbo tell me how Verona fixes this? And just, this book is therapy, right? That's what we're doing here.
Wow. Yeah. God. I mean, like, the levels of relating to Lucy and Verona in these two chapters are so off the charts.
Yeah. Like, I love doing both of these chapters back to back because it was just like seeing both sides of this argument as you sort of, as the two characters start to tie the argument itself into their broader problems, like we've kind of been begging them to. And, like, yeah, just sort of relating to both sides, or at least in my case, relating to Verona's and seeing the hurt I caused my ex in Lucy's. It was so good.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the part that really felt like a personal attack was that bit where Sylvia says, I found there's a fine line between stepping back, processing, and then fixing the problem, and the other possibility, which is to step back, process, and let it become procrastination instead.
Mm.
And it was just like, oh, okay, just fucking attack me directly next time.
Wabu has got you there. Verona spots an other with her mother who seems to be coming after her, so she splits off from her mum to deal with it, luring it into a thrift store.
Yeah.
Trying to think if there's a pun that can be made to the lyrics of Macklemore's Thrift Store. Couldn't think of one in time.
This other, it kind of catches you off guard with just how like brazen it is, like just fucking attacking with innocence kind of nearby.
Yeah. It's a weird one because any other can be dangerous in the right situation, but this one just feels so ineffectual. Like, it just kind of like trips over randomly. It's like, I don't know. It's just like such a doofus of another, right? And given what is about to happen, it makes me feel like it was only sent after Verona as a way to like lure the witch hunters towards her or something. Like it wasn't really sent to her by whoever sent it, presumably Massa. It wasn't sent to her to actually attack her. It was just so that the witch hunters and Verona would cross paths and that would be the actual attack.
Yeah. I think like Verona theorizes that at one point too, but I think hearing you say it like that, like pretty much seals it, that like this was his idea and he's basically taken over Kennet's tactic of being the one who sits at the side and lets the other two weaken themselves. Because, that makes a lot of sense. Like, I guess if you're Massa, just send something that you know rather than bouncing back will just attack the nearest practitioner and just make sure you're not the nearest practitioner.
Mm.
And that presumably, like, your niece isn't either.
Mm.
And then you'll be, looking good. I mean, I thought it was hilarious because, like, part of me, whenever a fight like this starts in the chapter, one thing I try to think about is, like, why would Wobbo make this person the villain in this chapter? And I think Verona pretty much spells it out for us. When she first is in the thrift shop fighting it, she thinks, when the set paths were clear, they were fast, fierce, and alert. Unfamiliar environment, change of pace, it slowed down a lot, got distracted. And I was like, wait, Verona, are you talking about yourself or the other? Right, this is like exactly what she's dealing with in this chapter. And it's just so, it's sort of so funny that, yeah, she's sort of fighting an opponent who is this kind of crazy, exaggerated version of like one of her own issues.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't put that together, but I think that's very funny. I do like this, that this is kind of a low stakes start to this chapter. Like, Verona is wary, but not in too much active danger here, and is basically kind of like in this low stakes situation, running through her options for how she can deal with it. Again, like, just as a great way for us to find out what she could do in a relatively low stakes environment so that we know what those options are for later when Verona starts using them when they come back, right? The enter key, the odd one out, etc. Like, it's just a great, again, just kind of by Wobbo, great work setting it up in a way that makes sense, but also sets things up for when things really pop off.
Yeah. Like, great point. Like, I guess that ties into what we're just talking about with both this other and Verona. It's sort of like her thoughts are a bit more coherent, and like she's able to just sort of focus when it's just this other. The second there's like three people to focus on, she kind of gets overwhelmed, and then she pulls back again when she manages to go upstairs and is just fighting Cleo.
Mm.
It's like when there's just sort of one enemy that she can focus on, even with like very limited tools, she can do a lot. But the second she's sort of overwhelmed by a handful of opponents, like she can get cornered very easily.
Mm. Yeah, true.
We should also call out, this is where we get the explanation of the care package she was sent by Clem. Especially just because, like, I guess we'll touch on it more later, but it's kind of the shittiness and drawbacks of these items that ultimately end up saving the day.
Mm.
Like, jumping ahead a bit, Cleo ultimately fails by making the fatal mistake of thinking that Verona's equipment is worth having. It's like whenever these Clem things come up, you can just tell, like, Wobbo has so much fun coming up with these like short little story synopses, like just that ability he has to paint an entire extra world and story in the background with one paragraph is so fun.
Yeah, like, 100%.
Clem accidentally becoming the lieutenant in a drug cartel just could be its own story. Like,
yeah, I feel like Clem is a character that just has such a depth of stories to tell, and I it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and you can tell Wobbo almost can't help himself but include a couple of them every time Clem comes up, and it's like it's reasons like this that get me excited for, you know, there's been talk of doing a Sergeant Hall story at some point, and you know, like if something like that happens, it'll almost be a shame if Clem isn't the main character most of the time.
100%.
There's so much potential just in her alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Things go from bad to holy shit as Cleo and Francis arrived. And what a moment it is. The door opens, the bell jangles, and we get, "We will," Cleo the witch hunter answered. "Thank you." And it's just like, oh fuck. As soon as you see it's Cleo, immediately you know things are going very shit.
Yeah, another witch hunter is bad, but Cleo is like, well, this is not going to go well.
Yeah.
Because there's no talking out of it with Cleo.
I had still kind of been hoping that one of the witch hunters that Musa killed was Cleo, because I thought that would clear the path for things to be a bit easier for the Kennedys and the...
We're not going to get off that easy, Ruben. Well, yeah,
exactly. I mean, like, exactly right. In hindsight, it's so stupid, because the fact that it would make things easier for the Kenneteers is exactly why it would never happen.
Do we know? So I think because it gets mentioned that a couple have died.
I think
we know?
It's mentioned that Musa killed three, and the only one we really know is Harris. Got, like, gutted.
Yeah, but we don't know who the other two is. I can't imagine Elise is one, because she was too fun.
Yeah, I can't imagine Elise would be one. I think probably Mr. Brokenheart is fine as well, but who
knows?
Yeah,
Renfro, I don't think has had a line. Like, I think we've been introduced to Renfro by name, and that's essentially it.
Yeah.
So, that's that kid may as well be wearing a red shirt, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, I'm assuming we'll find out more soon. But yeah,
It is worth saying. It was at this point that I sort of realized, because Cleon stuff came in, and there was always a part of me that was like, it was when I was reading Lucy's one, and we went to fight against Muster, and there was part of me that was almost like, oh yeah, Muster's still here. Like, because we had our break for the three chapters diving into the Carmine Alcazar.
Yeah, Muster and the Witch Hunters haven't been on our mind for a few chapters, but they've still been around doing shit.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was sort of this point that I started to look at this and be like, I'd forgotten that the Kennedys just sort of checked out for a day and a half. Like, Lucy helping John was after they took a day off to do those rituals. This is like the first action Verona scene in like 2 days. It's funny that as we're counting down these days and every day is important, the Kennedys just almost haven't been in the fight for the last couple of days.
Should we touch on the fact that Cleo and Francis are willing to just straight murder an innocent lady? Like, not just an innocent lady, an innocent Scottish lady. Like,
is she Scottish?
Or just a fan of Scotland, whatever, like, whatever the fuck that means. But yeah, like, we already knew that Cleo is a fucking psychopath, but it's so... The extent to which Cleo is a psychopath makes Elise feel almost irredeemable in my eyes. Like, how can someone like Elise, who seems moderately reasonable, and not reasonable, but closer to reasonable, or someone like Harris, who, again, not reasonable, but doesn't seem like a monster, how can they justify working with someone like Cleo, who is just fully willing to murder somebody innocent? There's no justification for it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, like, we're starting to learn more about these Montreal witch hunters, and it's just... Like, everyone we've met from the Lighthouse, some of them are pretty intense and borderline monstrous, but they all got there in a way, like, they were so much more sympathetic. Cleo's just come in from Montreal and is just selling, like, just what has to be the worst version of witch hunting. Like, every time she sort of explains what she does and how she's different from practitioners, I just keep, all I'm hearing is, that just sounds like the practice with extra steps. She's taking magical items to use them. She's keeping the practitioner fingers. I mean, we've already talked about this, but it's just like,
yeah,
her whole MO is just like arguably almost as bad as Muster's. At least as bad as Alexander or Bristow. And I mean, we did obviously get a peek at Montreal's situation in Mile End. And I think that sort of really sells, like, the problem with, like Cleo's just sort of unapologetically always increasing the amount of conflict. Like, she's kind of that worst case scenario version of Lucy, right? Like, which is why it's ironic Lucy is the one who hasn't had to fight her yet. But, Cleo is the Lucy who enjoyed seeing Alexander die and decided she needed to do more of that, is almost what it feels like.
Yeah.
I don't know, because, yeah, the Lighthouse, they find victims, and they find people who want to fight back and bring balance, whereas, like, Montreal, it sounded more like a gang or a mafia, I don't know, but, she says they, go out and they find people who, could be sports stars or whatever, but who are just too angry, and they just empower them to fight and be shitty.
Yeah, it feels like classic fascist group recruitment tactics, right?
Find
angry people, stoke up their anger so that they are willing to see their cause as, like, the only just cause, and anything else is collateral damage that's worthy of sacrificing for the cause. And it's just
that is
unbelievably fun.
That is the comparison I was reaching for, absolutely. And especially, like, hearing her describe it, I was like, Cleo, is that actually any better than, like, the inheritance bullshit we see in the practice? Like, in terms of recruitment. Like, Montreal, they go out and they find angry, capable people and make them angrier and more capable. Mm. I'm like, is that really any better than having, like, idiots raised to be, successive idiots? As opposed to something like the Lighthouse, where they find like victims and try to help them find strength and stability while also taking care of the bad guys, mostly. Or like, you know, the Kenneteers, who are like, you know, chosen as ambassadors for their like local fucking others. It's just, yeah. The more we see of Cleo, the more I'm just like, Cleo, you're worse. Like, how do you not see that?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we got to stick our own muster in a room together. Just, you know, whichever one comes out, we'll deal with. But yeah.
Yeah.
And poor Frances. She's fucking getting Frances ready to become just like her, which is upsetting.
Yeah. Why? Crazy to me that Frances would want to become more like Cleo. He sees how crazy she is in this chapter. I mean, Frances is the one who points at the old lady and then does a kind of slitting his throat gesture. So clearly he's already pretty far gone.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really seen anyone who came out of a bunch of Fey shenanigans with, you know, their capability for niceness fully intact.
Niceness, yeah, exactly.
But, like, yeah, he seems aware that Cleo is worse, but shows absolutely no resistance to the idea of becoming that. Like, that's what's upsetting, is he's still this clearly very impressionable 13-year-old boy. Mm. And I guess it's like that comparison you make. Like, I'm thinking of like the alt-right playbook sort of stuff now, if people haven't watched that video. But yeah, it's sort of like he sort of knows that it's bad, but not enough to necessarily fight it, because he knows a lot of the magic stuff is also very bad. And so it's like, without other people stepping in, Cleo's just going to be able to radicalize him, and he's not going to fight it. And that's the last thing anyone needs.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather this kid go and live with Shelley and Daniel. And like, that's also not an ideal situation, trusting those two to fucking manage another person.
Yeah. So Verona trades banter back and forth with them as a stalling tactic, which is good, but does not last forever. And a fight breaks out with Verona pretty desperately fighting for survival here.
Yeah, I love the moment where they swap bags, not just because it's a fucking baller ass move from Verona, the way she snatches Cleo's bag, but just this amazing idea of Wabo introduces us to all of Clem's, or I guess all of Verona's tools and a few of Cleo's, and then just sort of immediately switches them around. So now we're very familiar with what Cleo has, and Verona's holding a bag of shit she doesn't really know what it does. It's such a great little idea, just to change things up for us and the characters.
Yeah, it's a very cool moment. You're right. It's a very cool trick. Verona with the water pistol is very interesting to me, because she's tempted with this dangerous power and she thinks about it. She considers it for two full paragraphs, and it feels like she's close to the right frame of mind to go for it. And obviously the parallel here is using the furs, right? Like, Verona could choose to use the furs and take the seat and, you know, do whatever it is that she would want to do with that. Use this power to make things right, uses power to have people leave her alone, uses power for whatever she thinks of. I don't know. Like, she doesn't do it with the water pistol. She takes a less wild option. She kind of breaks the water pistol, removes it from play. Like, she does the right thing here, but it's just a reminder to me of, like, Verona's headspace means that she's close to being willing to make this choice.
Yeah, it's really rough. I mean, so there wasn't a chance for me to do Jess and Verona watch this week, obviously. But this feels like it ties into Jess's exact concern with Verona. And it's a concern that Verona has about herself. She spells it out later on, that it like scares her that she considers doing stuff like this. But then also when you're in her head in the moment, like you see it, like, I mean, that's the tricky thing with really any kind of power like this, is you, if you're a good person, you don't want to abuse it. But then at the same time, if you've got people pushing you, like, I mean, like, Cleo's literally trying to kill her, right? So it's like, it gets harder and harder to cross that line when you have access to these tools and you are trying to act in self-defense. I don't know. It's just, I get the dilemma Verona is faced with here. Especially when you add on to it that as a person, she's very right now, insecure in her own abilities and potential. We'll see that spelled out a lot more when the rest of the team shows up. I don't know. This has been something that we've noticed about Verona for the whole story, and Verona's noticing it too. And it'll be interesting to see where it goes, because I don't know how you reconcile that. Like, if you are someone without potential but you don't want to be, how do you stay off that path?
Yeah, it's a hard question. And it's a question that I feel like we haven't really resolved for Verona yet. I think the question of why would she take the furs is still dangling a bit.
I still don't see her taking the furs, but like, yeah, doing something else stupid like that would certainly be...
But I mean...
That would line up.
Elliot...
I admit, I can't think of anything better to sort of culminate this part of her character arc. But
she's so desperate to avoid even thinking about the situation of going back to live with her dad. Like, that situation clearly has... She's willing to do so much to make that have a clean resolution. Like, I really do think... I don't think she's there yet, of course, but I do think that that's the kind of thing that could get her into the frame of mind that would consider doing this, right?
I mean, yeah, but just the glimpse she got of how the Carmine lives in 13.1 makes me think she wouldn't like
that's
see
a very
that as
fair
an out.
Point. That's the strongest argument against it that I've heard.
I agree this will manifest in her having to make a choice of some kind. I just don't know if it would be the furs. But I don't know. I find this such an interesting and relatable dilemma. I mean, I've never had anything quite like this, obviously. But I guess, that idea of, if you do feel like you are having to hold back in all these ways all this time, and then people sort of start to come at you for it, like, how do you try to keep doing that? Like, I find that it gets harder and harder to justify. And you see people like Lucy who would just never even consider it. I said there was no Jess and Verona watch this week, but I should point out, I can't remember who it was now, I'm sorry for not giving you the credit you deserve. I think somebody in our Reddit thread pointed out in last week's Jess and Verona watch, I was confused that Jess and Verona shared that smile about Verona killing Bristow. Somebody on Reddit pointed out that they read it as Jess was pissed that Verona brought up the ghost ritual, so Jess brought up Bristow to fuck with her, and that's what they were smiling about. And that makes more sense than any read I had, so I'm going with that as my headcanon until something else comes up, I suppose. But that just makes more sense to me than those two actually both smiling about it.
Fair enough.
So, and that also means that we're back to every moment of Jess and Verona watch being a form of tension.
Yeah.
Even if it was a jovial one.
Yeah. Verona is scrapping. She does pretty well. She gets a few good blows in, but seems to be really struggling to get away when luckily the rest of the gang show up, Avery, Lucy, and John, to save her.
Yeah. Like, yay team is sort of her reaction, but not really.
Yeah. I'm sure she's glad that they're here to save her. There's obviously, I mean, I think when she sees Avery come in, her response is like, Avery was first through the door because of course. And I'm like, Verona, you're in a life or death situation. Chill out with the snark for once.
Oh yeah. No, but she has the thought as she's leaving of like, she's glad that she's alive, but, this is this problem Verona has. Again, I could possibly just be projecting myself on here again, but it's this idea of like Verona's not great at teamwork all the time. And so the thing is, like, what she sees here isn't effective teamwork, which is the rest of the team coming to save her. She sees like a personal failure because she needed saving. I think that that's coming from this insecurity relating to her own powers and abilities and competence that we sort of talked about a lot. But it's just like it's such an unfortunate and terrible headspace for her to have about it. Like, yeah, the fact that she has friends who, like, if you look at it from Avery's perspective, Avery having friends come in and save her life is like, you know, fucking her dream come true. Like, that's what she wants. She wants a team that she can work on. Whereas, like, Verona, I guess just a bit more selfishly, is just a lot more focused on the fact that she needed a team to come and save her, she was in a 3-on-1 fight. Like, of course she did. Like, yeah, I don't know. This is just like sort of another thread that she's dealing with, I think, is like her insecurities leading her to not necessarily be the best team player. And I think that overlaps with the communication issues she and Lucy are having. Like this need to go and process alone. Oh yeah, we'll get there in a sec. But, you know, it's good and it's understandable, but it's also can make her really bad at being a team member, as I think we've arguably seen a bit recently. So it's just, I don't know. It's not that easy to get over, but it's something she's going to need to try, because she doesn't need to be the same as Avery to be a member of a team, but she needs to change something to be a bit better of a member on this team, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think it's worth pointing out, Cleo, the last time we saw Cleo by herself was very handily defeating Avery and John, right? Verona here is up against Cleo and Francis, and is effectively keeping up with them while she is gainsaid. And it's just like, it's such a marker to me that Verona is so exceptionally talented at this. You're right that she's not that much of a team player, but I think she just kind of needs to get through her head that she is really strong at this. And the fact that she's being saved here is not necessarily a negative. It's just she's outnumbered, right?
Yeah, no, yeah, I guess that's kind of exactly like what I'm trying to say is like, yeah, she... All she's able to see is the failure part of it, because, and I think it's coming 100%. From that insecurity. Like, yeah, you're right. Like, Cleo went 2-on-1 against Avery and John.
Yes,
and brought them to a draw. Verona achieved essentially the same result, almost like in a 1-on-1. Like exactly. Like, and this is the problem, because Verona's insecurity, like her doing this and only seeing the failure, is leading to her having the emotional strife and other things that, like, you know, cause fights similar to the one she's having with Lucy. That one, it's maybe only a small part of it, but it's like that distance there is like, it's things like this that are causing that. And so, yeah, like it's definitely something to worry about from her end, is if she can't start to see her own value, she's going to continue to not value the others' contributions, because she'd be too worried about failing herself and do stupider things to try and prove herself.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we call out some great moments from this fight? One, when Claire's gun misfires because the odd one out has snuck in as a bullet. I just think that's so wonderful. Such a wonderful payoff to the odd one out. And I hope we see more of it, because it is such a cool idea.
Yeah, because like for a bit, I was like, why would Cleo's gun misfire? Like, surely she's better than that, like, to have equipment that would misfire. So I assumed somebody had done magic. But then, yeah, when Verona spelled out it was the old one out, I was like, oh, that's fucking so good. Like, Cleo stole Verona's shit and it backfired because it's bad stuff. Yeah. Right. Like, all of these items are great, but the odd one out, it was the one I was like, that's really fun, but I don't see how it's useful. And Verona kind of found the one situation where it is.
Yeah.
Wait, so imagine like sticking it in Moss's set of implements or something. I don't think that's how it works, but can you get it to mimic like one of Raquel's collection or something?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I just, God, what a cool thing it is.
Yeah, one of the funnest items Wabo came up with in this chapter and already delivering.
Again, think it's hilarious. After they leave, the shopkeeper lady says to Verona, you know, oh, I can't imagine it. A fellow Scotland fan faced with all that. Like, being a Scotland fan is like a thing that exists. It's just so silly, and I really love how much levity it brings to this very tense chapter.
Yeah, this lady's like undercurrent of just being weirdly obsessed with Scotland was very fun. I wanted to call out, apart from just after the fight, that I thought was kind of darkly funny. Verona like tells Lucy and Avery that she needs this time alone to process. And, you know, there's like a kind of a big moment for Lucy where she's like now in a state where she can give Verona that space. and you know, John touches her shoulder to really sort of sell the relationship of last chapter to that moment. But I love that Verona just sort of turns to Avery and she's like, I'm sorry, Ave, I wanted to focus on you, spend an afternoon bonding, do a thing with you after my mum left. And Ave responds, it's cool. I'm managing. Just when I have my turn to do my own thing, you don't necessarily get, maybe roll with it. And I was like, oh, fuck, is Ave setting up for her telling them she's going to leave town?
Oh, shit, I didn't even think of that. Oh, my God.
I was like, that's kind of cold-blooded because now, because Verona agrees to that. So yeah. Now Verona can't make a big deal out of Avery leaving if that's the next one that comes up.
Yikes. What a top trick.
It's kind of like, if that's an intentional sort of setup. I mean, I can't imagine Avery's actually planning to gainsay or anything, but like, I was like kind of cold-blooded getting her to agree to try and roll with something.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, I do like this moment with Lucy and Verona here. Like, Lucy's starting to learn her lesson. I think Verona is starting to become more of aware of the lessons she needs to learn. So yeah, we'll see.
Mm. Yeah, hopefully. So yeah, Verona is kind of shaken by this fight and by all the kind of tension and conflict over the past few days. So she goes to relax with her least judgmental friends, Peckersnot and Tashlit.
Yeah, and it's such a nice moment. Like, I think after seeing her for so long, just struggle with all this shit going on, especially while she was grounded, her finally getting this space she needs to just process stuff is, yeah, really nice.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's a really nice moment. I mean, we've been obviously feeling how much Verona is struggling, but it is a representation of growth that she has people, in quotes, that she's willing to kind of open up to a bit and just kind of be a bit more vulnerable around, which she hasn't really had that much before.
Yeah, or, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if opening up is exactly the right phrase, because she only really says two words to them after a few hours. It's like what really sort of seems to sell it to her is the fact that she doesn't need to, but she can talk. Like, it's like the lack of pressure that works for her. I'm thinking of the line after she says, I'm terrified. She's like, what she loves about the reactions of the two of them is they don't say that she shouldn't be, but they also don't say that she should be. Like, it's one of those things when, you know, you don't want to hear either, right? Like, if you're terrified of all these things, you don't want somebody to sort of dismiss it and say, oh, don't worry, it'll all be fine. But then you also don't want the response of, yeah, you probably should be. There's a very good chance you'll die or end up living with your dad.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely got that.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, it's just interesting because as much as I love her getting this moment to process, obviously, as this chapter ends, we haven't yet seen if it's going to lead to anything. I guess the way it ends on, the chapter ends on it makes me think it probably will, but at least given my own history with this sort of thing, I'm thinking of that line from her mom about how this can just lead to procrastination. So part of me is still worried that Verona will do the same sort of thing I would, which is sit here for 4 hours and come back and not really have achieved anything except escapism for a couple of hours, which doesn't help long term.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's not what's happened.
Yeah, for sure.
But I do think the other side of this is, I totally understand and share this need Verona has to escape and process for bits and pieces. But I think as the last few weeks have shown her, and as the rest of this week might, you don't always get that. Like, I don't know. I'd be interested to see if Verona has to confront the fact that sometimes she can't get this. I don't know. Maybe the point is that you want to have friends like Lucy and Avery so that you can. Like,
yeah.
The point is, you know, she gets us 2 weeks away with her mum and stuff because other people have her back, and that's why she needs to be in a team. But then the other part of me is, if you can't, that's when you should just be talking to Lucy about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a step in the journey of her being able to have these conversations with people as a way to, this is an unhealthy processing, and it is a growth moment, so it's worth, you know, celebrating that. But it would be nice if her and Lucy were able to neither of them really feels like they are able to bridge that gap at the moment, and it'd be nice if they were able to together.
Yeah, well, like, I do get the vibe that Verona getting this time, and if she is able to get thoughts in order, she might come back and be more willing to actually talk to Lucy about this. Like, my read on it for a long time has been that part of the reason Verona has been so shitty at Lucy and everyone else all the time is because she isn't getting this time alone to process it.
Mm.
So, like, ideally, her having this time will actually make her better at having the conversations she does need to have with Lucy. Like, you know, whether that is just, like, telling her to butt out or whether it is, like, actually hearing Lucy out on her concerns. Like, whatever. I at least for myself feel that, like, yeah, as I get more stressed and I'm not getting that time to digest things, I get a lot more snippy and less willing to talk about things because I don't feel like I have my thoughts in order. So that's been my read on what Verona's doing here. I'm just still holding out that concern that sometimes I will go away and think on something for a couple of hours and it doesn't help. And I just hope this wasn't that for Verona. I hope she at least sorted out a few of the things.
Yeah. Yeah. Hope so. But that's the end of the chapters for this week.
Yeah. Don't forget, we have an ongoing discussion question.
Yes.
Which is, what enticements would it take for you to take the role as the judge? And which judge would you want to be?
Yeah. I look forward to reading everyone's answers. We'll get to those next week. As a reminder as well, you can also leave predictions for what you think is going to happen in the story in our Pale Predictor form, which you can find the link to in the show notes down below. Leave a prediction for what you think is going to happen, and if we like the predictions, we'll read them out, and you might get points, and that's cool.
Mysterious points, yeah. Yeah.
You can redeem them, but I won't say for what.
Okay, I'll be interested to talk to you about that after this.
Well, I'm not going to tell you either, Elliot.
Oh, God.
You and the listeners will have to figure out what the points are worth.
It's a riddle. I mean, obviously, I think the main category on there, like the first one that's listed is whodunit. That might be a bit of a redundant category now, but feel free to jump in there and, do the MISC category, which is probably the main one now, and give us your miscellaneous predictions.
Yeah. If you want to do that, you can find the link in the show notes. You can also find the link to our discussion thread for the discussion question Elliot mentioned, as well as links to anything you might need, like our Twitter, where we tweet about all kinds of cool things. You can go there and follow us, and maybe Elliot will post a funny tweet in the next few days. I don't know. He might.
Oh, shit, pressure's on. I'll have to think of something funny.
Yeah.
We've also got a website, doofmedia.com. That's where you can find out about all the other great shows. Obviously there's Pale in Comparison, which is getting up to a very exciting part of Pact. I can't wait for more of that show to unfold. the Doof cast has also had some great episodes recently as they're sort of reaching the end of their current dissecting directors.
What You Say is about to have their final episode of their current format, I believe.
Yeah, although it's also kind of breaking their format. They're just finishing up the OC because it sounds like season 4 sucks.
Yeah. If you want to support all of the things we've mentioned, all of the shows on the Doof Media Network, you can become a patron at patreon.com/Doof Media. Gives you access to all kinds of cool things. Bonus shows actually is what I think is the coolest one, and that's one of the smallest donation goals you can get, so definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Donation perks, I don't know what you call it.
Yeah. One of the coolest levels. Yeah. Yeah, that $10 tier with the bonus shows. The bonus shows are some of our best stuff, I reckon. Mm-hmm. Matt and Scott are doing great ones. Matt and his brother do another great one. Ours is fun. I wouldn't say it's like brilliant,
well, it's not,
but it's fun.
Especially highbrow, but every time we record an episode, it's one of my most, like, we have such a blast doing the recordings. We did a very fun one that has just come out, and it's delightful.
I think, you've got the entire spectrum covered between Matt and his brother's show and our show. Like, if you want nerdy intellectual shit, You got Matt and his brother's show. If you want the opposite of that, you've got our show.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't forget to stop by Wildbo's Patreon as well, patreon.com/Wildbo. If you're contributing to that Patreon, then essentially you can think of it as your money is getting converted into, like, you know, lists of items that Clem has and stuff. And that's a pretty good use of your money. So spare him some change if you can.
Yeah. And yeah, catch ya round.
See ya.